This is Audible.
Wavesound Audiobooks presents The Dry by Jane Harper, narrated by Stephen Shanahan.
Prologue. It wasn't as though the farm hadn't seen death before, and the blowflies didn't discriminate. To them, there was little difference between a carcass and a corpse. The drought had left the flies spoiled for choice that summer.
They sought out unblinking eyes and sticky wounds as the farmers of Kiwara levelled their rifles at skinny livestock.
No rain meant no feed, and no feed made for difficult decisions, as the tiny town shimmered under day after day of burning blue sky. "It'll break," the farmers said as the months ticked over into a second year. They repeated the words out loud to each other like a mantra, and under their breath to themselves like a prayer. But the weathermen in Melbourne disagreed. Besuited and sympathetic in air-conditioned studios, they made a passing reference most nights at six. Officially, the worst conditions in a century. The weather pattern had a name, the pronunciation of which was never quite settled. El Niño. At least the blowflies were happy. The finds that day were unusual, though. Smaller, and with a smoothness to the flesh. Not that it mattered. They were the same where it counted. The glassy eyes. The wet wounds. The body in the clearing was the freshest. It took the flies slightly longer to discover the two in the farmhouse, despite the front door swinging open like an invitation. Those that ventured beyond the initial offering in the hallway were rewarded with another, this time in the bedroom. This one was smaller, but less engulfed by competition. First on the scene, the flies swarmed contentedly in the heat as the blood pooled black over tiles and carpet.
Outside, washing hung still on the rotary line, bone dry and stiff from the sun.
A child's scooter lay abandoned on the stepping stone path. Just one human heart beat within a kilometre radius of the farm. So nothing reacted when deep inside the house, the baby started crying. Chapter 1. Even those who didn't darken the door of the church from one Christmas to the next could tell there would be more mourners than seats. A bottleneck of black and grey was already forming at the entrance as Aaron Falk drove up, trailing a cloud of dust and cracked leaves. Neighbours, determined but trying not to appear so, jostled each other for the advantage as the scrum trickled through the doors. Across the road, the media circled. Falk parked his sedan next to a ute that had also seen better days and killed the engine. The air conditioner rattled into silence and the interior began to warm immediately.
He allowed himself a moment to scan the crowd, although he didn't really have time.
He dragged his heels the whole way from Melbourne, blowing out the 5-hour drive to more than six. Satisfied no one looked familiar, he stepped out of the car. The late afternoon heat draped itself around him like a blanket. He snatched open the back seat door to get his jacket, searing his hand in the process. After the briefest hesitation, he grabbed his hat from the seat. Wide-brimmed in stiff brown canvas, it didn't go with his funeral suit. But with skin the blue hue of skimmed milk for half the year and a cancerous-looking cluster of freckles the rest, Falk was prepared to risk the fashion faux pas. Pale from birth, with close-cropped white blonde hair and invisible eyelashes, he'd often felt during his 36 years that the Australian sun was trying to tell him something. It was a message easier to ignore in the tall shadows of Melbourne than in Kiwara, where shade was a fleeting commodity. Falk glanced once at the road leading back out of town, then at his watch. The funeral, the wake, one night, and he was gone. 18 hours, he calculated, no more. Keeping that firmly in mind, he loped towards the crowd, one hand on his hat as a sudden hot gust sent hems flying. Inside, the church was even smaller than he'd remembered. Shoulder to shoulder with strangers, Falk allowed himself to be ferried deeper into the congregation. He noticed a free spot along the wall and darted in, carving out a space next to a farmer whose cotton shirt strained taut across his belly. The man gave him a nod and went back to staring straight ahead.
Fork could see creases at his elbows where the shirt sleeves had until recently been rolled up. Fork removed his hat and discreetly fanned himself. He couldn't help glancing around. Faces that at first had seemed unfamiliar came more sharply into focus, and he felt an illogical rush of surprise at some of the crow's feet, silver-streaked hair and gained kilos sprinkled throughout the crowd. An older man two rows back caught Fork's eye with a nod, and they exchanged a sad smile of recognition. What was his name? Fork tried to remember. He couldn't focus. The man had been a teacher. Fork could just about picture him at the front of a classroom, gamely attempting to bring geography or woodwork or something else alive for bored teenagers, but the memory kept flitting away. The man nodded at the bench beside him, indicating he would make space, but Fork shook his head politely and turned back to the front. He avoided small talk at the best of times, and this, unquestionably, was a million horrific miles from the best of times. God, that middle coffin was small. Lying between the two full-size ones only made it look worse, if that were possible. Tiny kids with combed hair plastered to their skulls pointed it out. Dad, look, that box is in football colours. Those old enough to know what was inside stared in appalled silence, fidgeting in their school uniforms as they edged a little closer to their mothers. Above the three coffins, a family of four stared down from a blown-up photograph. Their static smiles were overlarge and pixelated. Fork recognised the picture from the news. It had been used a lot. Beneath, the names of the dead were spelled out in native flowers. Luke, Karen, Billy. Fork stared at Luke's picture. The thick black hair had the odd grey line now, but he still looked fitter than most men on the wrong side of 35. His face seemed older than Fork remembered, but then it had been nearly 5 years. The confident grin was unchanged, as was the slightly knowing look in his eyes. Still the same were the words that sprang to mind. Three coffins said differently. Bloody tragic. The farmer at Fork's side spoke out of nowhere. His arms were crossed, fist wedged tightly under his armpits. It is, Fork said. You knew him well? Not really. Only Luke, the... For a dizzy moment, Fork couldn't think of a word to describe the man in the largest coffin. He mentally grasped about, but could only find cliched tabloid descriptions. The father, he landed on finally. We were friends when we were younger. Yeah, I know who Luke Hadler is. I think everyone does now. Still live around this way, do you? The farmer shifted his large body slightly and fixed Fork properly in his gaze for the first time. No, not for a long time. Right. Feels like I've seen you, though. The farmer frowned, trying to place him. Are you not one of them bloody TV journos, are you? No, police, in Melbourne. That right? You lot should be investigating the bloody government for letting things get this bad. The man nodded to where Luke's body lay alongside those of his wife and six-year-old son. We're out here trying to feed this country. Worst weather in 100 years, and they're crapping on about scrapping the subsidies? In some ways, you can hardly blame the poor bastard. He stopped, looked around the church. It's an effing scandal, that's what it is. Fork said nothing as they both reflected on the incompetencies of Canberra. The potential sources of blame for the dead Hadler family had been thrashed out at length over newspaper pages. You looking into this, then? The man nodded his head towards the coffins. No, just here as a friend, Fork said. I'm not sure there's anything still to look into. He knew only what he'd heard on the news along with everyone else, but it was straightforward according to the commentary. The shotgun had belonged to Luke. It was the same one later found clamped into what had been left of his mouth. No, I suppose not, the farmer said. I just thought with him being your friend and all. I'm not that kind of officer anyway. Federal. With the Financial Intelligence Unit.
Means nothing to me, mate.
Just means I chase the money. Anything ending with a few zeros, that's not where it should be. Laundered, embezzled, that sort of thing. The man said something in reply, but Fork didn't hear him. His gaze had shifted from the three coffins to the mourners in the front pew. The space reserved for family.
so they could sit in front of all their friends and neighbours who could in turn stare at the backs of their heads and thank God it wasn't them. It had been 20 years, but Falk recognised Luke's father straight away. Jerry Hadler's face was grey. His eyes appeared sunken into his head. He was sitting dutifully in his spot in the front row, but his head was turned. He was ignoring his wife sobbing by his side and the three wooden boxes holding the remains of his son, daughter-in-law and grandson. Instead, he was staring directly at Falk. Somewhere up the back, a few notes of music piped out from speakers. The funeral was starting. Jerry inclined his head in a tiny nod, and Falk unconsciously put his hand in his pocket. He felt the letter that had landed on his desk 2 days ago, from Jerry Hadler. 8 words, written with a heavy hand. Luke lied. You lied. Be at the funeral. It was Falk who looked away first. It was hard to watch the photographs. They flashed up on a screen at the front of the church in a relentless montage. Luke celebrating as an under-10s footballer, a young Karen jumping a pony over a fence. There was something grotesque now about the frozen grins, and Falk saw he wasn't the only one averting his gaze. The photo changed again, and Falk was surprised to recognise himself. A fuzzy image of his 11-year-old face looked out at him. He and Luke were side by side, bare-chested and open-mouthed as they displayed a small fish on a line. They seemed happy. Falk tried to remember the picture being taken. He couldn't. The slideshow continued. Pictures of Luke, then Karen, each smiling like they'd never stop. And then there was Falk again. This time, he felt his lungs squeeze. From the low murmur that rippled through the crowd, he knew he wasn't the only one shaken by the image. A younger version of himself stood with Luke, now both long-limbed and freckled with acne. Still smiling. But this time, part of a foursome. Luke's arm was slung around the slim teenage waist of a girl with baby blonde hair. Falk's hand hovered more cautiously over the shoulder of a second girl with long black hair and darker eyes. Falk could not believe that photo was being shown. He shot a look at Jerry Hadler, who was staring straight ahead, his jaw set. Falk felt the farmer next to him shift his weight and move a calculated half step away. The penny had dropped for him, Falk thought. He forced himself to look back at the image, at the foursome, at the girl by his side. He watched those eyes until they faded from the screen. Falk remembered that picture being taken. One afternoon near the end of a long summer. It had been a good day, and it had been one of the last photos of the four of them together. 2 months later, the dark-eyed girl was dead. Luke lied. You lied. Falk stared down at the floor for a full minute. When he looked back, time had moved on, and Luke and Karen were smiling with stiff formality on their wedding day. Falk had been invited. He tried to remember what excuse he'd offered for not attending. Work, almost certainly. The first pictures of Billy began to appear. Red-faced as a baby, then with a full head of hair as a toddler. Already looking a bit like his dad. Standing in shorts by a Christmas tree. The family dressed up as a trio of monsters, their face paint cracking around their smiles. Fast forward a few years, and an older Karen was cradling another newborn to her breast. Charlotte, the lucky one. No name spelled out in flowers for her. As if on cue, Charlotte, now 13 months old, began to wail from her front row spot on her grandmother's lap. Barb Hadler clutched the girl tighter to her chest with one arm, jiggling with a nervous rhythm. With her other hand, she pressed a tissue to her face. Falk, no expert on babies, wasn't sure if Charlotte recognised her mother on the screen. Or perhaps she was just pissed off at being included in the memorial when she was still very much alive. She'd get used to it, he realised. She didn't have much choice. Not many places to hide for a kid destined to grow up with the label Lone Survivor. The last strains of music faded away and the final photos flashed up to an awkward silence. There was a feeling of collective relief when someone turned on the lights. As an overweight chaplain struggled up the 2 steps to the lectern, Falk stared again at those dreadful coffins. He thought about the dark-eyed girl, and a lie forged and agreed on 20 years ago as fear and teenage hormones pounded through his veins. Luke lied. You lied. How short was the road from that decision to this moment? The question ached like a bruise. As an older woman in the crowd turned her gaze away from the front, her eyes landed on Fork. He didn't know her, but she gave an automatic nod of polite recognition. Fork looked away. When he glanced back, she was still staring. Her eyebrows suddenly puckered into a frown and she turned to the elderly woman next to her. Fork didn't need to be able to lip read to know what she whispered. The Fork boy's back. The second woman's eyes darted to his face, then immediately away. With a tiny nod, she confirmed her friend's suspicion. She leaned over and whispered something to the woman on her other side. An uneasy weight settled in Fork's chest. He checked his watch. 17 hours. Then he was gone. Again. Thank God. Chapter 2
Aaron Fork, don't you bloody dare leave!
Fork was standing by his car, fighting the urge to get in and drive away. Most of the mourners had already set off on the short trudge to the wake. Fork turned at the voice and, despite himself, broke into a smile. Gretchen, he said as the woman pulled him into a hug, her forehead pressed against his shoulder. He rested his chin on her blonde head and they stood there for a long minute, rocking back and forth.
Oh my God, I'm so glad to see you here.
Her voice was muffled by his shirt. How are you? He asked when she pulled away. Gretchen Schoner shrugged as she slipped off a pair of cheap sunglasses to reveal reddened eyes.
Not good. Bad, really. You?
Same.
You certainly look the same, she managed a shaky smile. Still working the albino look, I see.
You haven't changed much either. She gave a small snort, but her smile firmed.
In 20 years, come on.
Fork wasn't just being flattering. Gretchen was still entirely recognisable from the photo of the teenage foursome that had flashed up during the service. The waist Luke had thrown his arm around was a little thicker now, and the baby blonde hair might have been helped by a bottle, but the blue eyes and high cheekbones were pure Gretchen. Her formal trousers and top were a shade tighter than traditional funeral attire, and she moved a little uneasily in the outfit. Fork wondered if it was borrowed or just seldom worn. Gretchen was looking him over with the same scrutiny, and as their eyes met, she laughed. She immediately looked lighter, younger.
Come on.
She reached out and squeezed his forearm. Her palm felt cool against his skin. The wakes at the community centre will get it over with together. As they started down the road, she called out to a small boy who was poking something with a stick. He looked up and reluctantly abandoned what he was doing. Gretchen held out a hand, but the child shook his head and trotted in front, swinging his stick like a sword.
My son Lockie, Gretchen said, glancing sideways at Fork.
Right, yes. It took Fork a moment to remember that the girl he knew was now a mother. I'd heard you'd had a baby.
Heard from who? Luke?
Must have been, Fork said. A while ago now, though. Obviously. How old is he?
Only 5, but already the ringleader half the time.
They watched as Lockie thrust his makeshift sword into invisible attackers. He had wide-set eyes and curly hair the colour of dirt, but Fork couldn't see much of Gretchen in the boy's sharp features. He scrambled to recall if Luke had mentioned her being in a relationship or who the boy's father was. He thought not. He liked to think he'd have remembered that. Fork glanced down at Gretchen's left hand. It was ringless, but that didn't mean much these days.
How's family life treating you? He said, finally. Fishing.
It's okay. Lockie can be a bit of a handful, Gretchen said in an undertone. And it's just him and me, but he's a good kid, and we get by. For now, anyway.
Your parents still have their farm?
She shook her head. God, no. They retired and sold up about 8 years ago now. Moved to Sydney and bought a tiny unit 3 streets away from my sister and her kids. She shrugged. They say they like it. City life. Dad does Pilates, apparently.
Fork couldn't help smiling at the image of the plain-speaking Mr. Shona focusing on his inner core and breathing exercises.
"You weren't tempted to follow?" he said. She gave a humorless laugh and gestured at the parched trees lining the road. "And leave all this?" "No, I've been here too long. It's in the blood, you know what it's like." She bit the sentence short and glanced sideways. "Or maybe you don't. Sorry." Fork dismissed the remark with a wave of his hand. "What are you doing these days?" "Farming, of course. Trying to, anyway. I bought the Kellerman place a couple of years back. Sheep." "Really?" He was impressed. That was a sought-after property, or at least it had been when he was younger. "And you?" she said. "Heard you went into the police." "Yeah, I did. Federal, still there." They walked on in silence for a way. The frenetic birdsong coming from the trees sounded the same as he remembered. Up ahead, groups of mourners stood out like smudges against the dusty road. "How are things around here?" he asked. "Awful." The word was a full stop. Gretchen tapped a fingertip to her lips with the nervous energy of an ex-smoker. "God knows it was bad enough before. Everyone's scared about money and the drought. Then this happened with Luke and his family, and it's so bad, Aaron. So bad. You can feel it. We're all walking around like zombies, not sure what to do, what to say, watching each other, trying to work out who'll be next to snap." "Jesus." "Yeah, you can't imagine." "Were you and Luke still close?" Fork asked, curious. Gretchen hesitated, her mouth set into an invisible line. "No, we hadn't been for years, not like it was when it was the four of us." Fork thought about that photo. Luke, Gretchen, himself, and Ellie Deacon, with her long black hair. They'd all been so tight. Teenage tight, where you believe your friends are soulmates and the bonds will last forever. Luke lied. You lied. "You obviously stayed in touch with him," Gretchen said. "On and off." At least that was the truth. "We caught up occasionally for a beer when he was in Melbourne, that sort of thing." Fork paused. "I hadn't seen him for a few years, though. Gets busy, you know. He had his family. I've been working a lot." "It's all right. You don't have to make excuses. We all feel guilty." The community centre was heaving. Fork hung back on the steps and Gretchen tugged on his arm. "Come on, it'll be okay. Most people probably won't even remember you."
"There'll be plenty who do, especially after that photo at the funeral."
Gretchen made a face. "Yeah, I know, I got a shock too. But look, people have got plenty of things to worry about today other than you. Keep your head down, we'll go out the back." Without waiting for an answer, she grasped Fork's sleeve with one hand and her son with the other and led them in, easing her way through the crowd. The air was stifling. The centre's air conditioner was trying its best but fighting a losing battle as mourners huddled in the indoor shade. They were mingling solemnly, balancing plastic cups and plates of chocolate ripple cake. Gretchen made her way to the French doors where collective claustrophobia had forced stragglers out into the patchy playground. They found a spot of shade by the fence line and Lockie ran off to try his luck on the scalding metal slide. "You don't have to stand with me if it's going to sully your good name," Fork said, tipping his hat a little further forward to shield his face. "Oh, shut up. Besides, I do a good enough job at that myself." Fork scanned the playground and spotted an elderly couple he thought might once have been friends of his father's. They were chatting to a young police officer who, suited and booted in full dress uniform, was sweating under the afternoon sun. His forehead glistened as he nodded politely. "Hey," Fork said, "is that Barbarisa's replacement?" Gretchen followed his gaze. "Yeah, you heard about Barbaris?" "Of course. Sad loss. Remember he used to scare us all to death with horror stories about kids who mucked about with farm equipment?" "Yeah, he'd had that heart attack coming for 20 years. "Still, it's a real shame," Fork said, meaning it. "So who's the new guy?" "Sergeant Rako, and if it looks like he's stepped straight into the deep end, it's because he has." "No good? Seems like he's handling the crowd okay." "I don't know, really. He'd only been here about 5 minutes when all this happened." "Hell of a situation to land in your first 5 minutes. Gretchen's reply was cut short by a flurry of movement by the French doors. The crowd parted respectfully as Barb and Jerry Hadler emerged, blinking in the sunlight. Holding hands tightly, they made their way around the groups of mourners. A few words, a hug, a brave nod, move on.
"How long since you last spoke to them?" Gretchen whispered.
20 years until last week," Falk said. He waited. Jerry was still on the other side of the playground when he spotted them. He pulled away from a rotund woman mid-hug, leaving her arms embracing fresh air. "Be at the funeral." Falk was there, as instructed. Now he watched as Luke's father approached. Gretchen got in first, intercepting Jerry with a hug. His eyes met Falk's over her shoulder, his pupils huge and shining. Falk wondered if some form of medication was helping him through the day. When Jerry was released, he held out his hand, enclosing Falk's palm in a hot, tight grip. "You made it then," he said neutrally as Gretchen hovered by their side.
"I did," said Falk. "I got your letter."
Jerry held his gaze.
"Right.
Well, I thought it was important you be here, for Luke. And I wasn't sure you were going to make it, mate." The final sentence hung heavily in the air.
"Absolutely, Jerry," Falk nodded. "Important to be here."
Jerry's doubts hadn't been unfounded. Falk had been at his desk in Melbourne a week earlier, staring blankly at a newspaper photo of Luke when the phone rang. In a halting voice Falk hadn't heard for 2 decades, Jerry had told him the funeral details. "We'll see you there," he'd said, without a question mark at the end. Falk had avoided Luke's pixelated gaze as he mumbled something about work commitments. In truth, he'd still been undecided. 2 days later, the letter arrived. Jerry must have posted it as soon as he'd hung up the phone. "You lied. Be at the funeral." Falk hadn't slept well that night. They both now glanced awkwardly at Gretchen. She was frowning off into the middle distance, where her son was clamouring shakily over the monkey bars. "You're staying in town tonight," Jerry said. "No question mark that time either," Falk noted. "Above the pub." A wail went up from the playground and Gretchen made a noise of frustration.
"Shit, I could see that coming.
Excuse me." She jogged off. Jerry grabbed Falk's elbow and angled him away from the mourners. His hand was shaking.
"We need to talk before she comes back."
Falk wrenched his arm away in a tiny, controlled movement, aware of the crowd behind them. Unsure who was there, who was watching.
"For God's sake, Jerry, what is it you want?"
He forced himself to stand in a way he hoped appeared relaxed. "If this is supposed to be some sort of blackmail, I can tell you right now that's a non-starter."
"What? Jesus, Aaron, no. Nothing like that."
Jerry looked genuinely shocked.
"If I wanted to stir up trouble, I'd have done it years ago, wouldn't I? I was happy to let it lie. Christ, I would love to let it lie, but I can't now, can I? With this. Karen and Billy both dead. Him not even 7 years old yet."
Jerry's voice broke.
"Look, I'm sorry about the letter, but I needed you to be here. I have to know."
"Know what?" Jerry's eyes looked almost black against the bright sunlight.
"If Luke had killed before..."
Falk was silent. He didn't ask what Jerry meant.
"You know."
Jerry bit back his words as an officious woman wobbled up to inform him the chaplain needed to speak to him, right away if possible.
"Jesus, it's bloody chaos,"
Jerry snapped, and the woman cleared her throat and arranged her expression into one of martyred patience. He turned back to Falk.
"I'd better go. I'll be in touch."
He shook Falk's hand, holding it a beat longer than necessary. Falk nodded. He understood. Jerry looked hunched and small as he followed the woman away. Gretchen, having soothed her son, wandered back to Falk. They stood shoulder to shoulder as together they watched Jerry go.
"He seems dreadful," she said in an undertone.
"I heard he was screaming at Craig Hornby in the supermarket yesterday, accusing him of making light of the situation or something. Seems a bit unlikely. Craig's been his friend for 50 years. Falk couldn't imagine anyone, least of all stoic Craig Hornby, making light of those 3 awful coffins. Was there really no warning at all from Luke? He couldn't help himself. Like what? A fly landed on Gretchen's lip and she brushed it away impatiently. Him waving a gun around in the main street threatening to do in his family? God, Gretch, I'm only asking. I meant depression or something.
Sorry, it's this heat. It makes everything worse.
She paused.
Look, there's barely anyone in Kiwara who's not at the end of their tether. But honestly, Luke didn't seem to be struggling any more than anyone else, at least not in a way anyone's admitting seeing.
Gretchen's thousand-yard stare was grim.
It's hard to know, though, she said after a pause. Everyone's so angry, but they're not just angry at Luke exactly. The people paying him out the most don't seem to hate him for what he's done. It's weird. It's almost like they're jealous.
Of what?
Of the fact that he did what they can't bring themselves to do, I think, because now he's out of it, isn't he?
While the rest of us are stuck here to rot, he's got no more worrying about crops or missed payments or the next rainfall.
Desperate solution, Fork said, to take your family with you.
How's Karen's family coping?
She didn't really have any from what I heard.
You ever meet her?
Fork shook his head.
Only child, Gretchen said. Parents passed away when she was a teenager. She moved here to live with an aunt who died a few years ago. I think Karen was pretty much a haddler for all intents and purposes.
Were you friends with her?
Not really.
The clink of a fork against a wine glass rang out from the French doors. The crowd slowly fell silent and turned to where Jerry and Barb Hadler stood hand in hand. They looked very alone, surrounded by all those people. It was only the two of them now, Fork realized. They'd also had a daughter once, briefly. She was stillborn when Luke was three. If they'd tried for more children after that, they hadn't succeeded. Instead, they'd channeled all their energy into their sturdy, surviving son.
Barb cleared her throat, her eyes darting back and forth over the crowd.
We wanted to thank you all for coming. Luke was a good man.
The words were too fast and too loud, and she pressed her lips together as if to stop more escaping. The pause stretched out until it was awkward, then a little longer. Jerry stared mutely at a patch of ground in front of him. Barb prized open her lips and took a gulp of air.
And Karen and Billy were beautiful. What's happened has been,
she swallowed,
so terrible. But I hope eventually you can remember Luke properly, from before. He was a friend to many of you, a good neighbour, a hard worker, and he loved that family of his.
Yeah, till he butchered them.
The words that floated from the back of the crowd were soft, but Fork wasn't the only one to whip his head around. The glares pinpointed the speaker as a large man wearing his mid-40s badly. Fleshy biceps that were more fat than muscle strained against his T-shirt as he folded his arms. His face was ruddy, with a scruffy beard and the defiant look of a bully. He stared down each person who turned to chastise him, until one by one they looked away. Barb and Jerry appeared not to have heard. Small mercies, Fork thought.
Who's the loudmouth?
He whispered, and Gretchen looked at him in surprise.
You don't recognise him? It's Grant Dow.
You're kidding. Fork felt the hairs on his neck prickle and turned his face away. He remembered a 25-year-old with lean muscles like barbed wire. This bloke looked like he'd had a tough 2 decades since.
He looked so different.
Still a prize, dickhead. Don't worry, I don't think he's seen you. You'd know about it if he had. Fork nodded, but kept his face turned. Barb started crying, which the crowd took as a sign the speech had ended, and people gravitated instinctively towards her, or away, depending on their sentiment. Fork and Gretchen stayed put. Gretchen's son ran up and buried his face in his mother's trousers. She hoisted him with some difficulty onto her hip, and he rested his head on her shoulder, yawning.
Time to get this one home, I think, she said.
When are you off back to Melbourne?
Fork checked his watch. 15 hours.
Tomorrow, he said out loud. Gretchen nodded, looking up at him. Then she leaned forward and wrapped her spare arm around his back and pulled him close. Fork could feel the heat of the sun on his back and the warmth of her body in front.
It's good to see you again, Aaron. Her blue eyes wandered over his face as though trying to memorize it, and she smiled a little sadly. Maybe see you in another 20 years? He watched her walk away until he couldn't see her any more.
Chapter 3. Fogg sat on the edge of the bed, listlessly watching a medium-sized huntsman perched on the wall. The early evening temperature had dropped only fractionally as the sun disappeared. He'd changed into shorts after a shower and his damp legs prickled uncomfortably against the cheap cotton bedsheet. A stern sign hanging from an egg timer next to the shower head had ordered him to keep ablutions to 3 minutes. He'd started to feel guilty after 2. The dull sounds of the pub thudded up through the floor, the occasional muted voice ringing a distant bell. A small part of him was curious to see who was down there, but he felt no desire to join in. The noise was punctuated by the muffled smash of a dropped glass. There was a short pocket of silence followed by a chorus of derisive laughter. The huntsman moved a single leg. Fogg jumped as the room phone on the bedside table rang out, its tone shrill and plastic. He was startled but not surprised. He felt like he'd been waiting for it for hours.
Hello? Aaron Fogg. Have a call for you.
The barman's voice was deep with a trace of a Scottish accent. Fogg pictured the imposing figure who had taken his credit card details in exchange for a room key without comment 2 hours earlier. Fogg had never seen him before, and he was certainly would have remembered a face like that. Late 40s, with broad shoulders and a full orange beard, the barman was a backpacker who had stayed and stayed, Fogg guessed. He'd shown no spark of recognition at Fogg's name, just an air of disbelief that anyone would use the pub for a purpose not directly linked to alcohol.
"Who's calling?" Fogg asked, although he could guess.
"You'll have to ask him yourself," the barman said. "You want a message service, you'll have to stay in a nicer establishment, my friend. Putting him through now."
The line went silent for a long moment, then Fogg heard breathing.
"Aaron, you there? It's Jerry."
Luke's father sounded exhausted. "Jerry, we need to talk."
"Yes. Come out to the house. Barb wants to speak to you anyway."
Jerry gave him the address. There was a long pause, then a heavy sigh.
"And listen, Aaron, she doesn't know about the letter. Or any of this. Let's keep it that way, yeah?"
Fogg followed Jerry's directions along gloomy country roads and 20 minutes later turned his car into a short paved driveway. A porch light cast an orange glow over a neat weatherboard home. He pulled to a stop and the screen door screeched open, revealing Barb Hadler's squat silhouette. Her husband appeared behind her a moment later, his taller frame throwing a long shadow onto the drive. As Fogg climbed the porch steps, he could see they were both still wearing their funeral clothes, wrinkled now.
"Aaron, my God, it's been so long. Thank you for coming. Come in," Barb whispered, reaching out her free hand to him.
She was clutching baby Charlotte close to her chest and rocking her with a vigorous rhythm.
"Sorry about the baby. She's very restless. Won't go down."
From what Fogg could see, Charlotte was fast asleep. "Barb," Fogg leaned in over the child to give the woman a hug. "It's so good to see you." She held him for a long moment, her plump arm around his back, and he felt something in him relax a fraction. He could smell the sweet floral notes of her hairspray. It was the same brand she'd used when she was still Mrs. Hadler to him. They moved apart, and he was able to look down at Charlotte properly for the first time. She looked red-faced and uncomfortable, pressed against her grandmother's blouse. Her forehead was creased into a tiny frown that, Fogg noticed with a jolt, reminded him uncannily of her father. He stepped into the light of the hallway, and Barb looked him up and down, the whites of her eyes turning pink as he watched. She reached out and touched his cheek with the warm tips of her fingers.
"Just look at you. You've barely changed," she said.
Fogg felt illogically guilty. He knew she was picturing a teenage version of her son next to him. Barb sniffed and wiped her face with a tissue, shredding little flecks of white onto her top. She ignored them, and with a sad smile gestured for him to follow. She led him down a hallway lined with framed family snaps that they both studiously ignored. Jerry trailed in their wake. "Got a nice place here, Barb," Falk said politely. She had always been scrupulously house-proud, but looking around now he could see the odd sign of clutter. Dirty mugs crowded a side table, the recycling bin was overflowing, and stacks of letters stood unopened. It all told a tale of grief and distraction. "Thank you. We wanted something small and manageable after..." She hesitated for a beat, swallowed. "After we sold the farm to Luke." They emerged onto a deck overlooking a tidy patch of garden. The wooden boards creaked beneath their feet as the night soaked some of the ferocity out of the day's heat. All around were rose bushes that were neatly pruned, but very dead.
"I tried to keep them alive with recycled water," Barb said, following Fork's gaze. "Heat got them in the end." She pointed Fork to a wicker chair.
"We saw you on the news. Did Jerry tell you a couple of months ago? Those firms ripping off their investors, stealing their nest eggs."
"The Pemberley case," Fork said. "That was a shocker."
"They said you did well, Aaron, on TV and in the papers. Got those people's money back."
"Some of it. Some of it was long gone."
"Well, they said you did a good job." Barb patted his leg. "Your dad would have been proud."
Fork paused. "Thanks."
"We were sorry to hear he'd passed. Cancer is a real bastard."
"Yes, Bal. 6 years ago, it hadn't been an easy death."
Jerry, leaning against the doorframe, opened his mouth for the first time since Fork arrived.
"I tried to keep in touch after you left, you know."
His casual tone failed to hide the note of defensiveness.
"Wrote to your dad, tried calling a couple of times. Never heard anything back, though. Had to give up in the end." "It's okay," Fork said. "He didn't really encourage contact from Kiwara."
An understatement. They all pretended not to notice.
"Drink?"
Jerry disappeared into the house without waiting for an answer and came out a moment later with three tumblers of whiskey. Fork took his in astonishment. He'd never known Jerry to drink anything much harder than a light beer. The ice was already melting by the time the glass was in his hand.
"Cheers."
Jerry tilted his head back and took a deep swallow. Fork waited for him to wince. He didn't. Fork took a polite sip and set the glass down. Barb looked at hers in distaste.
"You shouldn't really be drinking this stuff around the baby, Jerry," she said.
"Crying out loud, love, the kid doesn't care. She's dead to the bloody world,"
Jerry said, and there was a horrible pause. Somewhere in the inky garden, the nocturnal insects rattled like white noise. Fork cleared his throat.
"How are you coping, Barb?"
She looked down and stroked Charlotte's cheek, shook her head, and a tear dropped onto the little girl's face.
"Obviously,"
Barb began, then stopped. She blinked hard.
"I mean, obviously Luke didn't do it. He would never have done this. You know that, not to himself and certainly not to his beautiful family."
Fork glanced at Jerry. He was still standing in the doorway, glaring down into his half-empty drink. Barb went on.
"I spoke to Luke a few days before it happened and he was completely fine, honestly. He was normal."
Fork couldn't think of anything to say, so he nodded. Barb took it as a sign of encouragement.
"See, you understand because you really knew him, but other people around here, they're not like that. They just accept what they're told."
Fork stopped himself from pointing out that he hadn't seen Luke in 5 years. They both looked up at Jerry. He continued to examine his drink. No help to be found there.
"That's why we were hoping."
Barb looked back, hesitating.
"I was hoping you'd help us."
Fork stared at her.
"Help you how exactly, Barb?"
"Well, find out what really happened, to clear Luke's name, and for Karen and Billy and Charlotte."
At that, she started rocking Charlotte in her arms, stroking her back and making soothing noises. The baby still hadn't moved. "Barb." Fork leaned forward in his chair and placed his palm on her free hand. It felt clammy and feverish.
"I'm so sorry for what's happened. To you all. Luke was like a brother back then, you know that. But I am not the right person for this. If you've got concerns,
You've got to go to the police.
We've come to you.
She removed her hand.
You're the police.
The police who are equipped to deal with this sort of thing. I don't do that anymore, you know that. I'm with the financial side now. Accounts, money.
Exactly,
Barb nodded. Jerry made a small noise in his throat. Barb thinks money troubles may have played a part. He'd aimed for a neutral tone, fallen well shy.
Yes, of course I do, she snapped. Why is that so unbelievable to you, Jerry? Talk about burning a hole. If Luke had a dollar, he'd spend two to make sure it was gone.
Was that true? Fork wondered. He'd never known Luke to be too keen to put his hand in his pocket. Barb turned back to face him.
Look, for 10 years I thought we'd done the right thing selling the farm to Luke, but these past 2 weeks I've done nothing but worry. We saddled him with a burden that was too much. With the drought, who knows, everyone's so desperate. He might well have borrowed money from someone or had bad debts he couldn't pay. Maybe someone he owed came looking for him.
A silence stretched out. Fork found his glass of whiskey and took a decent swallow. It was warm.
Barb, he said finally, it might not feel like it, but the officers in charge really will have considered all these possibilities. Not very bloody well, Barb snapped. They didn't want to know. They drove over from Clyde and took one look and said, yep, another farmer gone off the rails, and that was that, open and shut. I could see what they were thinking. Nothing but sheep and fields, you'd have to be half off your nut to live here in the first place. I could see it in their faces.
They sent a team down from Clyde? Fork asked, slightly surprised. Clyde was the nearest big town with a fully stocked cop shop. Wasn't the local guy. What's his name?
Sergeant Rako. No, he'd only been here a week or so. They sent someone over.
You've told this Rako bloke you got concerns? Her defiant look answered his question.
We're telling you, she said.
Jerry put his glass down on the deck with a thud, and they both jumped. All right, I think we've said our piece, he said. It's been a long day. Let's give Aaron a chance to think things through, see what makes sense to him. Come on, mate, I'll see you out.
Barb opened her mouth like she wanted to protest, but closed it after a look from Jerry. She laid Charlotte down on a spare chair and pulled Fork into a damp embrace. Just think about it, please.
Her breath was hot against his ear. He could smell alcohol in her breath. Barb sat back down and picked up Charlotte. She rocked briskly until the child finally opened her eyes with an irritated wail. Barb smiled for the first time as she smoothed her hair and patted her back. Fork could hear her singing tunelessly as he followed Jerry down the hallway. Jerry walked Fork right to his car.
Barb's clutching at straws, Jerry said. She's got it into her head that this is all the work of some mythical debt enforcer. It's rubbish. Luke wasn't a fool with money. Having a tough time like everyone else, yes, and he took the odd risk, but he was sensible enough. He'd never have got mixed up in that sort of thing. Anyway, Karen did all the accounts for the farm. She would have said, would have told us if things were that bad.
So what do you think?
I think he was under a lot of pressure. And as much as it hurts me and I tell you it kills me, I think what happened was exactly what it looks like. What I want to know is whether I share the blame.
Fork leaned against the car. His head was pounding.
How long have you known? Fork said. That Luke was lying when he gave you an alibi? The whole time. So what's that, 20-odd years?
I saw Luke riding his bike alone on the day it happened. Nowhere near where you boys said you were.
I know you weren't together.
He paused.
I've never told anyone that.
I didn't kill Ellie Deacon. Hidden somewhere in the dark, the cicadas screeched.
Jerry nodded, looking down at his feet. Aaron, if I thought for a second that you had, I wouldn't have kept quiet.
Why do you think I didn't say anything?
It would have ruined your life. The suspicion would have followed you for years. Would they have let you join the police? Luke would have had the book thrown at him for lying. All that for what? The girl was still dead, killed herself realistically, and I know a fair few others thought so too. You boys had nothing to do with it.
Jerry struck the toe of his boot against the ground. At least, that's what I thought.
And now?
Now. Jesus, I don't know what to believe.
I always thought Luke was lying to protect you, but now I've got a murdered daughter-in-law and grandchild, and my own dead son with his fingerprints all over his shotgun.
Jerry ran a hand over his face. I love Luke. I would defend him to the end. But I love Karen and Billy as well, and Charlotte. I would have gone to my grave saying my son was incapable of something like this, but this voice keeps whispering, "Is that true? Are you sure?" So I'm asking you, here, now, did Luke give that alibi to protect you, Aaron? Or was he lying to protect himself?
There was never any suggestion Luke was responsible for what happened to Ellie, Fawkes said carefully.
No, Jerry said. Not least because you alibied each other, though. Eh? You and I both knew he was lying about that, and neither of us said anything. So my question is whether that puts the blood of my daughter-in-law and grandson on my hands.
Jerry tilted his face, and his expression was lost in shadow.
It's something to ask yourself before you go scurrying back to Melbourne.
You and I both hid the truth. If I'm guilty, so are you.
The country road seemed even longer on the drive back to the pub. Fork flicked on his high beams and they carved a cone of white light in the gloom. He felt like the only person for miles. Nothing ahead, nothing behind. He felt the sickening thud under the wheels almost before he registered the small blur streaking across the road. A rabbit. There, then instantly gone. His heart was pounding. He tapped the brake automatically, but was 1,000 kilos and 80 kilometres an hour too late. No contest. The impact had come like a blow to the chest, and it nudged something loose in Fork's mind. A memory he hadn't thought of in years slid to the surface. The rabbit was only a baby, shivering in Luke's hands. His fingernails were thick with grime. They often were. For Kiwara's 8-year-olds, weekend entertainment was limited. They'd been running fast through the overgrown grass, racing to nowhere, when Luke had stopped dead. He bent down among the long stalks, and a moment later stood, holding the tiny creature aloft. Aaron ran over to see. They'd stroked it, each telling the other not to press so hard. "He likes me. He's mine," Luke said. They argued about names all the way back to Luke's house. They found a cardboard box to put it in and loomed over to examine their new pet. The rabbit quivered a little under their scrutiny, but mainly lay still, fear masquerading as acceptance. Aaron ran inside to fetch a towel to line the cardboard. It took him longer than expected, and when he re-emerged into the bright sun, Luke was still. He had one hand in the box. Luke's head snapped up as Aaron approached, and he snatched his hand out. Aaron walked over, uncertain of what he was seeing, but feeling the urge to delay the moment when he would look inside.
"It died," Luke said.
His mouth was a tight line. He didn't meet Aaron's gaze.
"How?"
"I don't know, I just did."
Aaron asked a few more times, but never got a different answer.
The rabbit lay on its side, perfect but unmoving, its eyes black and vacant.
"Just think about it," Barb had said as Fork had left their home. Instead, as he drove down those long country roads, the dead animal still fresh under his wheels, Fork couldn't stop thinking about Ellie Deacon and their teenage gang of four, and whether Ellie's dark eyes had looked as vacant after the water had finished filling her lungs.
Chapter 4. The yellow police tape was still hanging in strips around the door of Luke Hadler's farmhouse. It caught the morning light as Fork parked next to the police car on a patch of dead grass out the front. The sun was still some way from its peak position, but Fork's skin was already tingling from the heat as he got out of the car. He put his hat on and surveyed the house. He hadn't needed directions. He'd spent almost as much time at that house growing up as he had at his own. Luke hadn't changed much about the place since he'd taken it over from his parents, Fork thought as he rang the bell. The chime echoed deep inside, and he was struck by the feeling of having travelled back in time. He felt such an uneasy certainty that a cocky 16-year-old would swing open the door that he almost took a step back. Nothing moved. Windows shrouded by closed curtains gazed out like a pair of blinded eyes. Fork had lain awake for most of the night thinking about what Jerry had said. In the morning he'd rung and told Jerry he could stay in town a day or two, only until the weekend. It was Thursday, he was expected back at work on Monday. But in the meantime, he would go to Luke's farm. He would look at the financials for Barb. It was the least he could do. Jerry's tone made it clear he agreed. It was almost literally the least Fork could do. Fork waited for a moment, then made his way around the side of the building. The sky loomed huge and blue over yellow fields. In the distance, a wire fence kept a shadowy tangle of bushland at bay. The property was very isolated, Fork noticed properly for the first time. It had always felt full of life when he was young. His own childhood home may have only been a short bike ride away, but it was completely invisible somewhere over the horizon. Looking around now, only one other house was in sight. A sprawling grey building hunched on the side of a distant hill. Ellie's house. Fork wondered if her father and cousin still lived up there, and instinctively turned his head away. He wandered through the yard until he found Sergeant Greg Rako in the biggest of three barns. The officer was on his hands and knees in the corner, rummaging through a pile of old boxes. A redback, nestled still and shiny in her web, was ignoring the activity 2 meters away from her. Fork rapped on the metal door and Rako twisted around, his face streaked with dust and sweat.
"Jesus, you gave me a start. Didn't hear anyone coming."
"Sorry. Aaron Fork, I'm a friend of the Hadlers. Your receptionist said you were here." He pointed to the redback. "You seen that, by the way?"
"Yeah, thanks. There are a couple around."
Rako stood and pulled off his work gloves. He attempted to brush the grime off his navy uniform trousers, but gave up as it made things worse. His neatly pressed shirt had sweat rings under the arms. He was shorter than Fork and built like a boxer, with curls cut close to his scalp. His skin was Mediterranean olive, but his accent was pure country Australia. He had a lift to his eyes that made him look like he was smiling even when he wasn't. Fork knew, because he wasn't smiling now.
"Jerry Hadler called and said something about you stopping by," Rako said. "Sorry to do this, mate, but you got some ID? Had a few nut jobs prowling around, sightseeing or something, I don't know."
Up close, he was older than Fork had first thought. Maybe 30. Fork noticed the sergeant discreetly check him over. Open, yet cautious. Fair enough. Fork handed over his driver's license. Rako took it like he'd been expecting something else.
"I thought Jerry said you were a cop."
"Just here in a personal capacity," Fork said.
"So not officially?"
"Not at all." Something flashed across Rako's face that Fork couldn't read. He truly hoped this wasn't going to descend into a pissing contest. "I'm an old mate of Luke's, back when we were teenagers." Rako looked at the license carefully before handing it back.
"Jerry said you needed access to the bank statements, account books, stuff like that."
"Sounds about right."
"Something going on there I should know about?"
"Barb asked me to have a look," Fork said. "As a favour."
"Right."
Despite being several centimetres shorter, Rako almost managed to look Fork straight in the eye.
"Look, if Jerry and Barb say you're good, I'm not going to stuff you around for the sake of it. But they're pretty vulnerable right now, so you come across anything I need to hear, you make sure I hear it, yeah?"
"No worries, just here to help them out."
Fork couldn't help glancing over Rako's shoulder. The cavernous barn was swelteringly hot, and plastic skylights gave everything a sickly yellow tinge. A tractor stood idle in the middle of the concrete floor, and various bits of machinery Fork couldn't identify lined the walls. A hose attachment snaked out of the nearest one near his feet. He thought it might be for milking, but wasn't sure. He would have known once. Now it all looked vaguely like instruments of torture to his city eye. Fork nodded towards the boxes in the corner.
"What are you looking for in there?"
"Nice try, mate, but you said it yourself, you're here in a personal capacity," Rako said. "Bank statements will be in the house. Come on, I'll show you the study."
"It's all right." Fork took a step back. "I know where it is. Thanks."
As he turned to leave, he saw Rako's eyebrows lift. If the guy had been expecting a fight over territory, Fork thought, he wasn't going to find one here. Still, he had to admire the man's dedication.
It was early, but it looked like Reiko had been up to his elbows for hours. Fork started towards the house. Stopped. Thought for a moment. Barb Hadler may have her doubts, but Reiko seemed like a cop who took things seriously. Fork turned back. "Listen," he said. "I don't know how much Jerry told you, but I know when I'm in charge it's a hell of a lot easier when I know what's going on. Less margin for a stuff-up." Reiko listened in silence as Fork told him Barb's theory of money troubles and debts being called in. "You think there's anything in it?" "I don't know. I'm sure there'll be money problems, you can tell that by looking around. Whether that means someone other than Luke pulled the trigger is another question." Reiko nodded slowly. "Thanks. I appreciate it." "No worries. I'll be in the study." Fork was barely halfway across the scorched yard when Reiko called out.
"Hey, wait a sec."
The sergeant wiped his face with his forearm and squinted against the sun. "You were good friends with Luke, yeah?" "Long time ago." "Say Luke wanted to hide something, smallish. Any idea where he'd stash it?" Fork thought for a moment, realised he didn't really need to think about it. "Maybe. What sort of thing?" "We find it, I'll show you." The last time Fork had laid on that particular patch of ground, the grass had been fresh and green. Now he could feel the yellow scrub scratching his stomach through his shirt. He'd led Reiko round to the far side of the house, testing the weatherboards with his foot. When he found the one he was looking for, he lay down and slid a stick under the bottom of the panel. It creaked a little under the strain, then gave way easily, coming loose in his hand. Fork looked up at Reiko, standing over him. "In there?" Reiko asked, pulling on his heavy-duty gloves. "What did he used to hide?" "Anything, really. Toys and junk food when we were kids. Booze a bit later. Nothing too exciting. The usual stuff kids don't want parents to see." Reiko knelt down. He thrust his arm into the gap up to the elbow and scrabbled around, feeling blindly. He withdrew it, clutching a handful of dried leaves and an old packet of cigarettes. He dumped them on the ground by his knees and went back in. This time, he pulled out the remains of a soft porn magazine. It was curled and yellowed at the edges, and something had eaten holes through the important bits. He tossed it aside in irritation and tried again, pushing his arm in as far as it would go. Reluctantly, he came out empty-handed. Nothing. "Here," Fork gestured for the gloves. "I'll have a go." He and Luke had never used to use gloves, Fork thought, as he thrust his hand into the dead space. Anything lurking under a house was no match for the immortality of kids and teenagers. He fumbled around, feeling nothing but flat earth. "Give me a clue what I'm looking for," he grunted. "A box, probably, or some sort of packaging." Fork groped about, pushing his arm in as far as it would go. The hiding spot was empty. He pulled his hand out. "Sorry," he said. "It's been a while." Reiko's knees clicked as he stood from his crouched position. He opened the battered cigarette packet, took one out, looked at it longingly, then slowly slid it back in. Neither of them spoke for a long moment. "It's the shots," Reiko said finally. "From the shotgun that killed the Hadlers. They don't match." "Don't match what?" "The brand Luke Hadler used. Used for years, as far as I can tell. The three shots fired that killed him and his family were Remington. The only ammunition I can find on this entire property is Winchester." "Winchester?" "Yep. I noticed when the inventory came through from Clyde, and it's been picking at me ever since," Reiko said. "So that's it. Box of Remington shots and I'd be a happier man."